Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. There hasn't been an Iraqi ambassador in Washington since the days of the first Gulf War. There has never been a woman in that post. But making those two changes are actually the least of the worries for Rend al-Rahim as she takes up her official duties in Washington. She has to figure out how to represent a country that is still, in so many ways, not a country. The American military still decides what's what in Iraq. But if the United States authorities are expecting a compliant and obedient diplomat in the person of Rend al-Rahim, they're in for a bit of a surprise. She has been routinely outspoken in her criticism of the way that the occupation is being managed, and now she'll have the diplomatic standing to make that case. Rend al-Rahim is our guest this hour. And we'd like to have you in the conversation with us. Do you see her appointment as an important step toward Iraq's independence? Can she actually make the case for her country as long as it is under occupation? And will it make a difference, either here or in Baghdad, that it's a woman who's the new ambassador? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. And Rend al-Rahim is joining us today from Washington. Welcome to the program.
Hello, Dick. Thanks for having me.
Nice to have you here. I understand that not 2 weeks ago you were in Baghdad with your family, kind of a reunion of sorts for the announcement that you'd be taking up these duties.
Yes, indeed. It was actually I united with my family in Iraq in September, and it was an extraordinary moment. We really never, ever thought we would all be there together. At any time in our living, in our lives, we kept looking at each other in disbelief, and it was just wonderful.
Now, you left back in the 70s. Your mother and father left shortly afterward. I think you left as a student, and your and your parents left because it was just getting too uncomfortable for them to work and to live there?
You know, we, like so many other Iraqis, were... there was political harassment against us and persecution. One of my uncles had been sentenced to a long jail period. My father was coming under political pressure. Somebody who was not in the immediate family but quite close to us was also killed by the regime of Saddam Hussein. And we felt the noose tightening, and we left in 1978 for good.
So what was it like for your father to be back there breathing Baghdad air?
You know, he is a man who is absolutely enamored of Iraq. He is the most ardent patriot I've ever known. And more than anything else, I was happy for him. He was blissful. He didn't care about the security concerns. The floor of the hotel he was staying at, or we were all staying at the time, received some rocket hits. I don't know if you remember that, just in sometime in November.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't faze him. He didn't pack up and leave. He didn't leave the country. He didn't leave his hotel room. He said, "I'm not budging. These people want to demoralize us, and I will not allow them to. I am going to hold my ground." It was really amazing.
And I guess a little of that patriotism rubbed off on you as well.
Yes, I think so.
Now, tell me how this actually works, because there isn't an elected president or prime minister or an elected cabinet in Iraq. So who exactly appoints you as an ambassador?
I was appointed by the Minister of Foreign Affairs, Mr. Hoshyar Zebari. And I was approved by the Governing Council. Now, so we do not have elected bodies, you're absolutely right, but we do have a governing council, we do have ministers, and I answer to them. I answer directly to the Minister of Foreign Affairs, he's my immediate boss, and indirectly to the governing council. And so, in fact, I am here to represent their views and their policies.
But if they also have to answer, at least in part, for some of the work that they're doing in Iraq to the American authorities that are in charge there, that creates kind of a funny little circle for you. You end up being the ambassador of an occupied country, representing that country to its own occupiers.
Yes, it is a little awkward, and I know you mentioned this in the introduction. Let me comment on a few things you said. You've mentioned it's not a country. It is a country. It's simply a country that doesn't have full sovereignty.
Okay, fair enough.
Also, that the U.S. doesn't actually decide what's completely. And I have to tell you that there has been an evolution, quite remarkable. I've spent most of my time since May in Iraq. And as you must know from my writings, I'm an observer and an analyst of the situation. In May, the U.S. authorities, what's known as the Coalition Provisional Authority, the CPA under Ambassador Bremer, held the view that any Iraqis appointed to a council should be advisors only. And there was a great outcry on the part of Iraqis, all Iraqis, that no, the Iraqis should not be advisors. They should be much more, that sovereignty should be vested in an Iraqi body. And we had been saying this to the U.S. since before the war. We had always said recommended and asked that sovereignty be immediately vested in Iraqis. Now, when the CPA was formed, this was not their initial intention. With time, when the Governing Council was formed in July, it was given some authorities, but not a large space. And I have watched the evolution of the Governing Council and the ministers who were appointed in September. And I've seen them acquire more and more authority. And I've seen the CPA, the Coalition Provisional Authority, cede powers to the Governing Council gradually and increasingly. And it has been a fascinating evolution, although legally the Governing Council does not have sovereignty. De facto, it has a lot of authority. And I can give you an example. When Turkey wanted to, when the U.S. asked Turkey to send troops into Iraq, the Turkish parliament decided that they will do so. Again, the Iraqi Governing Council and the Iraqi ministers held their ground. They said, no, we do not want any Turkish group troops. We do not want any troops from neighboring countries. And it was quite an embarrassing moment for Turkey and for the U.S. And yet, guess what? The Governing Council got its way. So there is, it's no longer a black and white situation where all power is within the CPA and none is with Iraqis. It is gradually changing.
I have, as you point out, been looking at some of your observations and your writings from your time in Iraq. You are a good observer. You point out, and I think this is an interesting puzzle for you, that increasingly, in the past few months, as the insurgents have made it more and more difficult for Americans to operate in Iraq and more difficult for those who are with Americans to operate freely in Iraq, increasingly Iraqi people are seeing the armored side of America only, all tank barrels, all barbed wire, and not seeing any of the sort of civil or humanist side. This is going to be a problem as these two countries try to negotiate a shift to sovereignty.
Yes, indeed. And this is one. This was one of the most distressing elements of the situation that I observed in the summer. The problem, of course, is that as the terrorist activities escalate, you only get a greater degree of militarization. And more buildings become barricaded. And access or interchange between American civilians and ordinary Iraqis becomes more and more restricted.
Or humiliating.
You know, the humiliating part has improved. And this is where I'm looking at this kind of with a historical perspective. Mm-hmm. For example, in October and November, no American males were ever searching women.
most checkpoints had become Iraqi man checkpoints rather than American man checkpoints. So there is an evolution in the stance and the posture of the U.S. military for the better. And I think that there had been so many complaints by Iraqis that the American posture had to change. Nevertheless, it is what the ordinary Iraqi in the street sees are the American tanks and Humvees, and this is not a healthy situation.
And if it breeds a form of cynicism or distrust, then the other point that you make, and this is the one that I would think would be most worrisome to you, that Iraqi patriotism becomes tangled up with anti-Americanism.
And this is a very dangerous situation. Now, Dick, let me just tell you, having looked sort of retrospectively at the evolution, I want to look ahead. We now have an acceleration of the building of an Iraqi civil defense force, Iraqi police, Iraqi border defense forces. Mm-hmm. And by the time I had left in November, there were lots of Iraqi police in the streets, and a lot of police stations had been opened throughout Baghdad, and I'm just really talking about Baghdad here. In fact, the situation in southern Iraq is far better. You don't see that many military inside the cities in the south. But in Baghdad itself, you have many more police stations. It is the police that people have first recourse to. That building and standing up in the military jargon of Iraqi security forces in all types and shapes will take the pressure off the American military from the need to patrol the streets and the neighborhoods and so on. And I am hoping that gradually, as we increase Iraqi numbers and capability, American military will be able to withdraw from neighborhoods and therefore be less visible to Iraqis as they go about their daily business. And that will be an extraordinary improvement in the situation.
Although the insurgents, as you and I both know, are equally aware of this, and that's why they're targeting Iraqi police officers and trying to discourage people from doing it. And in fact, there's a big feature in a morning newspaper today describing the feelings of Iraqi policemen who just don't want to do it, don't like being out with Americans.
You bet, you bet. The irony is that as the Iraqi police become more effective, and right now they're more effective against petty crime, for example, looting from shops, break-ins into houses, they are becoming more effective. But as they increase in number, they become targeted. And the fact is that whoever is doing this targeting, you call them insurgents, I frankly call them terrorists. Their objective is to disrupt the process of development and evolution in Iraq, whether it is social, economic, transfer of authority to Iraqis. They have declared that they are going to target Iraqis who in any way, shape, or form work with the United States, and that includes police and security forces.
The test of those security forces then being their patriotism and whether or not they are determined to face those others down. My guest is Rend al-Rahim. She is Iraq's new ambassador to the United States. If you have questions for her about the way that she sees the relationship between these two countries developing, terrific opportunity for you now. 1-800-423-8255. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Like so many people in Iraq in the mid to late 1970s, Rend al-Rahim and her family left that country. Rend went to study abroad, was educated at the Sorbonne and Cambridge University, worked later as a professor at the American University in Beirut and also as a banker, came to the United States about 22 years ago, and for the last 12 years, executive director of the Washington-based Iraq Foundation, a nonprofit organization focusing on democracy and human rights. 12 days ago, Rend al-Rahim was appointed Iraq's ambassador to the United States, and though she has yet to actually unlock the the embassy and get the cars and drivers in order, you'll be established there in short order, I gather.
I hope so.
Now, you have to establish credibility with people who don't know you yet in a couple of different places, one in official Washington and one in Iraq. Is that fair?
Yes, with a little sort of comment. Because I had been working at the foundation in Washington for the past 12 years, I have gotten to know a lot of people here and know my way around somewhat. And in Baghdad, I'm fortunate in knowing a number of the people who are in the governing council and the ministries, because I had worked with these people when they were in the opposition outside Iraq. So I have a little bit of a head start.
Well, more than a little bit of a head start. You've actually met several times already with President Bush in conversations about Iraq, have you not?
Once.
Oh, just once. Okay. Let's talk, though, about how you're seen in Iraq. I've been there a couple of times since Saddam Hussein left and picked up on the questions or the suspicion or the challenges that people in that country have for those who they see as exiles or returnees. Do you have to work to say, you know what, I don't really need to explain my bona fides to you because I've been living abroad, or is that going to be a problem?
You know, Dick, I must say I have not encountered that kind of sentiment of either suspicion or resentment of the people who came from the outside. It may exist, but I never came across it. In fact, the general sentiment that I have witnessed is that people in Iraq are welcoming of those of us who had to leave and came back, because they do see us as a connection to the outside world. They recognize that we have been a voice for the Iraqi people, that we had a hand in getting rid of Saddam Hussein, if indirectly. And I'll give you an example of this. I was working a lot with NGOs in Iraq for the past 5 months, and capacity building, training NGOs, and so on. And not once did I encounter the sentiment that, who are you to come to teach us? Quite the contrary, actually. They were pleased that we had accumulated certain expertise and knowledge of how NGOs work, and that we were transferring this expertise to them. And it is all a matter of how you approach the situation. If you approach it in a high-handed manner to come to say them, well, we're here, you know, we know more, we're better than you, and we are here to enlighten you and to lead you, of course there's going to be some resentment. But if you come with a certain amount of humility and say, we were outside, we did not share your suffering, but we tried to do our bit, and incidentally, we have acquired some skills that we think may benefit you, and we are here to serve. We're here to serve you. Then that is a much better approach and much more acceptable. And I think, certainly in my case, that's the attitude I went with. I am here to serve.
And no worry that you're seen perhaps as too close to official Washington.
You know, that can be an advantage, because I think every Iraqi understands that Washington is important, that the U.S. is a superpower, that Iraq has a special relationship with the U.S. right now. So it's seen as an advantage. And I have to tell you that Iraqis, even expatriate Iraqis who have gone back to Iraq, don't have... there are some interests that coincide, but in areas where we have felt that our interests maybe diverge, I think all Iraqis have made that divergence clear, both to Iraqis and to the CPA and so on. And I must say they have locked horns, as an example, over this Turkish issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's broaden the conversation to include some of the people who'd like to get in on the phone lines. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. And Rich is joining us now from Lumberton, North Carolina. Hi, Rich. Thanks for calling.
Thank you. Pleasure to talk to you. Yeah, I had a question for the ambassador. I was just wondering, with a lot of the country leaning more towards a theocracy with the Muslim religion, if the governing council leaned more that way, how would you present that to President Bush, and would you stand your ground to have a more of a religious government than a democracy.
Yeah. You know, this is a quite an interesting and complex issue. First of all, I do not believe that Iraq will have a theocracy in the model of Iran, for example. This is unlikely to happen. And the clerics in Iraq have traditionally been of the quietest tradition that did not get involved too much in politics and did not see a political, an overt political role for the clerics. Having said that, I should say that religion, Islam, is not just a theology. Islam is a culture, a set of values, and a set of traditions. And I think inevitably this is going to be reflected in our political culture as well. The values of Islam, the traditions, the culture of Islam will be reflected. The other thing you must keep in mind is that Iraq is a very diverse country. We not only have Muslims, but we have Muslim Sunnis and Muslim Shia. We have Christians. We have people from other religions. And also we have the religious people and the more secular people. It is politically and religiously very diverse. And I think everybody recognizes this in Iraq and that accommodations are going to have to be made. Let me just tell you a little bit that so far decisions in Iraq, political decisions, have been made on a consensus basis. And there has been a lot of dialogue, a lot of compromise. It hasn't been a sort of win-lose situation. The governing council and the ministers and the political parties have tried to work out compromises in which everybody sees their interests reflected. So it is not going to be a black and white situation as perhaps has happened in Iran.
Rich, does that answer your question?
Yes, thank you very much.
I mean, part of it that interests me, Rend, is, for example, are you a religious person?
I am not a fanatically religious person. I am a Muslim, and I adhere to Islam. But for example, I don't cover my head. I don't wear the hijab.
Right. The reason I ask is only because I'm seeing in the paper talk these days that when the country gets its full sovereignty, it may well be called the Islamic Republic of Iraq. And I'm wondering whether or not that means that its diplomats or its elected people, the question of the religious standing of its diplomats or its elected people will be relevant.
I don't think it will go this far. As I say, I think there will be a reflection of the culture and values of Islam. But what you're talking about is our legal restrictions on people to adhere very overtly to Islamic laws and Islamic requirements. I'm not sure that it will be that legally that binding and that black and white. But certainly the values of Islam are going to be reflected.
And when you look ahead to the significant shifts toward sovereignty, when it will come time for people to elect either regional councils or when there's a national election, how do you take a country which is as diverse as the one that you've just described and persuade people that what matters first is that they be Iraqi, not what matters first is that they be Kurdish or Shiite or that they be Northerners or Southerners? Because that, to me, and I know that's not necessarily your job, but this is very, very close to your heart. And that, in many ways, to me, is the task that will make or break the country.
I think the sense of citizenship is the most important sense that is going to have to prevail in Iraq. This does not mean that it's not there now. And in fact, if you talk to any Iraqi of any political or religious or ethnic persuasion, and that includes the Kurds, it includes the Assyrians and Chaldeans, the Shia, the Sunnis, everybody, if you ask them, point blank, they are going to say that what is most important is that they are Iraqis. But you have to recall that in Iraq for the last 40 years, we have had severe repression of certain population groups. and that Saddam restricted government and power not only... it's common to say that the Sunnis were in power, and I would say that that is an oversimplification. He restricted power to a certain city, a certain clan, which happened to be Sunni. Now, and many population groups were excluded. There was a disenfranchisement of a large number of people. What we have done now is lifted the lid on that, loosened the tight ropes that Iraqis were sort of bound in. And it is only natural right now that you have these disenfranchised groups coming up and saying, we need a role. We have to have representation. We have to have a say. We have to have an interest in that central government in Baghdad. And this is a natural reaction to the 40 years of exclusion that we have seen. This does not mean that the sense of Iraqiness is not powerful, but we have to, there is now a sort of balance between the two. And I think it's a natural reaction, and in time, this is going to be the Iraqi sense and the sense of citizenship has to prevail, because that's the only way that we're going to keep the country together.
See, I was last there 3 weeks ago, and you would have seen exactly the same thing when you were there in the early fall, that when you drive by the Kurdish Party headquarters in Baghdad, you drive by civilians standing on the sidewalk carrying guns, when you drive by al-Dawa Party, even the regional council offices in places like al-Mansur, they're all staffed by men with guns. It speaks about a country that is very, very reluctant to trust those other groups, that because of that type of repression, there's an unwillingness or a reluctance to be embracing and to say, you know, I'm a Shiite from Basra, but I'm every bit as much an Iraqi as the Kurdish man from Sulaymaniyah.
You know, you're absolutely right, and these are all the repercussions, the flotsam and jetsam of the repression of 40 years, the fragmentation of society that the Saddam regime practiced over 40 years. Saddam was very careful to sow this kind of distrust amongst the communities. And you have to remember that we are only 7 months away from 40 years of that kind of repression, of divide and rule. This is going to be a process that we have to go through. Now, one of the things that the good things about the Governing Council is that however it came about, and even though it wasn't elected, if you look at it, it includes Shia, it includes Sunnis, it includes the Communist Party, it includes the Syrians, it includes the Kurds. And, for example, in October and November, the president of the Governing Council, and you know we have a rotating presidency, mm-hmm. was Jalal Talabani, the head of the Patriotic Union of Kurdistan. Never in the history of Iraq has been what is, in effect, the chief of state or the chief of government, a Kurd.
You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Cambridge, Massachusetts. Andrew's joining us now. Hi, Andrew.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
My question is this. Have leaders of other Muslim nations been consulted about what they would like to see done to create a new government in Iraq? And could any of them serve a mediating function between insurgents and the CPA?
Do you have any leaders in or particular countries in mind, Andrew? You're talking about Pakistan or Indonesia? What sort of Muslim nations would be able to help out there?
I think Pakistan might be a good place to look, but there could be any number. Jordan, right. Maybe Morocco, who knows? But it just seems like there ought to be different diplomats who could work and could certainly gain access.
Right,
to
there's
people.
Certainly wisdom or experience there.
Yeah,
Brend, what about that?
There are really two parts to this question. First of all, the Governing Council and Iraqi ministers have gone out of their way to extend the hand of friendship to the countries in the region and Islamic countries and Arab countries. And I cite in this line that we had a very large delegation that went in October to the Organization of Islamic States in Kuala, at their meeting in Kuala Lumpur. And they spoke on behalf of Iraq, they took the Iraqi seat, and they dialogued with all the representatives of the Islamic States. The other part of this is that we had a delegation that went to the meeting in early November, I believe, to the Arab League. Iraq requested to fill the seat of Iraq that was left vacant by the old regime, and the Arab League ministers accepted. And so Iraq, again, participated as a member in the Arab League meetings. I should also cite that Jordan is even now engaged in training Iraqi policemen in Jordan, Iraqi civil defense forces, and Iraqi army recruits. This is the kind of friendly participatory relationship that Iraq wants with the countries of the region and Islamic countries. On the other hand, Iraqis are very sensitive about involvement of neighboring countries or other countries in Iraqi internal affairs. And I don't think that at this stage they have asked or are likely to ask Islamic countries to come in and have a say in the shape of an Iraqi government. Iraq is a complex society which is going through a difficult period of political, social, and physical rebuilding. And I think Iraqis want this to be, at least for the moment, an Iraqi affair.
I have to stop you there and thank Andrew for that call. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. A chance to speak to Iraq's new ambassador to the United States. Whether or not you see Rind al-Rahim's appointment as an important step towards independence for Iraq, what it says about relations between these two countries in the years ahead. 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Rind al-Rahim has yet to move into the ambassador's residence or the embassy in Washington, but she is formally Iraq's new ambassador to the United States, the first person to hold that position since the first Gulf War some 13 years ago, and the first woman ever to hold that position. Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. My name's Dick Gordon. Let's go to Watertown, Massachusetts. Ernesta's with us now. Hi, Ernesta, go ahead.
Hi, thank you for having me. I'd like to ask the ambassador about an issue which hasn't had much discussion in this country, which has to do with the U.S. economic role, which many international experts are now saying reforms that he has enacted directly contradict Iraq's constitution and are in breach of international law.
Like what, Ernesto? Give me an example.
Specifically, in September, Bremer enacted an Order 39, which announced that 200 Iraqi state companies would be privatized, decreed that foreign firms can retain 100% ownership of banks, mines, and factories, and allowed these firms to move 100% of their profits out of Iraq. And this is specifically in contravention of Hague regulations and also U.S. Army's law of land warfare, which says the occupant does not have the right of sale or unqualified use of property. And many international experts are decrying what the U.S. is doing here. And I'm wondering what the ambassador feels about this. If these are maintained, then the economic occupation of Iraq could become permanent with U.S. ownership of many of these firms.
That's a great question, Ren.
Very interesting question. You know, the Order 39 to privatize has actually not been ratified yet. And there is a discussion of whether private... It's not a question of whether to privatize or not. I think everybody, all the Iraqi ministers who are involved in the economic ministries, agree that privatization is essential. The question really is when to privatize, and whether to privatize, say, within the next 2 or 3 months, or to privatize gradually over a period of years. And what has happened in the interim period is that state-owned corporations have actually been leased. The Ministry of Industry has begun leasing certain industries that are state-owned. And a number
so the final decisions will be Iraqi decisions, not American decisions?
Absolutely. They will be they will be Iraqi decisions. However, there is consensus that, first of all, you have to understand that about 90% of the Iraqi economy was state-owned. And what, like all state-owned corporations in Eastern Europe and Russia, they were extremely badly run, they were losing money, and so on and so forth. So there is a consensus that privatization is extremely important.
All right, Ernesta, thank you very much for your call. To Virginia Beach, Virginia now. Tom, you're with us. Go ahead.
Yes. My question or comment is it too idealistic to think that the common man, the common Iraqi, I think about the movie The Patriot with Mel Gibson, where it shows how America was formed, where we just stood up and said, the common man said, we want to make a change. And I guess my question is, or comment is, if the Americans were to pull back and instill in the Iraqi people that this is your country, you need to want it, you need to take it for yourself, that you don't want a dictator, that you want to make a change, step back and let them actually play the role in doing it.
You mean sooner rather than later?
Exactly. You've got all these unemployed men with nothing to do, and, you know, somehow instilling them, I don't know if it's even, you know, going so far as to take the movie The Patriot, subtitle it and say, watch this. This is what we did.
That
you stand up and take your country back.
It might be a little dangerous, but
yeah.
I mean, I think
the idea. In other words, pull the Americans off of the streets. You know, get back out of the way, pull out into the desert or something to where we're there if you need us, mm-hmm. but we're not going to be there, and we're not going to be walking around your streets. Let the common man say, we're not going to let people loot. We're not going to let people, you know, walk around with guns telling people what to do. Or
it's a good question about an idea, Tom, whether or not the people there, Ren, want what Tom's describing.
I have to tell you that people want change. And when I wrote that the word democracy has become a mantra for Iraqis, I really meant it. Now, it's a question of how you explain democracy. I mean, is democracy just elections? There are various understandings of democracy, but that word has become sacrosanct in the Iraqi lexicon. Now, the really important thing, and by the way, the American pullback, I mean, the whole idea of transferring sovereignty to Iraqis by June 30th is precisely so that the Americans can pull back, can sort of take a much lower profile or disappear off the scene, and turn over to Iraqis all decision-making about their country and lawmaking and so on and so forth. But the one thing I need to talk about here is that what upholds a democracy? How does the common man express his views? The common man expresses his views, and society expresses its views through a vigorous civil society and through the institutions of the robust institutions of a vigorous civil society. Now, you have to understand that civil society was utterly demolished and decimated under the last regime. And we have people, we have a population, we have citizens, but they have no vehicles with which to express themselves right now, except through demonstrations, by the way. And they're doing that through demonstrations. They demonstrate against ministries. They demonstrate against the CPA, the coalition. They demonstrate against the military. But it's our only vehicle. We have no other vehicle. We have vehicles. We have no NGOs. We have no really strong professional associations. This is a matter that is going to take time to build. If we do not build a vigorous, robust civil society, we are not going to be able to establish democracy, maintain it, defend it, and uphold it. So please keep this in mind, that this is the building of civil society is important, we need to do it, and it takes some time.
Right.
Without it, we're not going to be able to do it.
So we can ask Mel Gibson to stand down just for now, Tom.
Right.
Thanks for your call. Burlington, Vermont. And Marcy, you're with us now. Thanks for calling.
Hi. My question is one of, like, your average listener who, you know, reads the newspaper and just I'm wondering if this is like the sort of like the pink elephant, I think that's the expression, of all this, the violence against the the bombs and the you know, every day we read of another GI, another American military getting killed, and I just wonder how you can proceed politically as an ambassador with that stuff going on. And is that something that, is that like a sort of just leftover Saddam Hussein loyalists, or is that something that really needs to be reckoned with and dealt with before you can, you know, go ahead and do the real work that you want to do, Ambassador?
Yeah, the question of violence, you should know that the violence also targets Iraqis. This is not a resistance. This is pure and simple terrorism. They have targeted Iraqis. They have, they've targeted Iraqi police stations. They've also targeted ordinary Iraqis on the streets, women and children. They've targeted the International Committee of the Red Cross, NGOs, and so on. So they're not only targeting Americans. These are people who do not want to see Iraq stand up on its feet and build itself. We don't know precisely who these are, but the strong suspicions is that there are groups who are loyal to the old regime, remnants of the Fidayeen and so on, plus groups from outside Iraq. In fact, most Iraqis now believe that there is a very high content of people who are from outside Iraq, because we simply, as Iraqis, cannot believe that these people are, that Iraqis would so wantonly kill hundreds of Iraqis. More Iraqis are dying than coalition troops are dying.
But it still makes the job of trying to manage diplomatic affairs, trying to manage government affairs, as Marcy is saying, extremely difficult. You're listening to The Connection from National Public Radio. 1-800-423-8255. Marcy, thanks for the call. Let's see if we can get one more in. Let's go to Baton Rouge, Louisiana. James, you're with us. Hi, go ahead.
Hey, Nick. Thanks for taking the call.
Yeah.
Wanted to compliment the ambassador for getting out word about, I think, what is the good news, because if you read the paper, like the lady just said, you think this thing is going down the tube, that nothing good is happening, and everything is bad, when in fact, I think it's a positive thing that's happening. In 7 months, more has happened, certainly, than ever happened after rebuilding in World War II. And there's a lot of really positive, good things going on. Sure, it's hard and there's a cost, but I think now is the time for the American people more than ever to stand up and say, let's finish the job, let's do it correctly, let's have a little patience and a little faith that, hey, Iraqi people want freedom. They're intelligent people. They love their kids. They're not idiots. And have a little faith, and let's look at some positive things that are going down instead of reading the paper and thinking that this thing is just all terrible.
Ambassador, do you share James' sense of optimism here?
Yes, I do. Look, it is not, everything is not 100% right. But let me tell you about the things that are good. And I wrote about this also in my report. I talked about a freedom index in one of these reports, and I have to tell you the freedom index is extremely high. You have more than 200 newspapers being published in Iraq. You have NGOs forming right, left, and center, interest groups, and so on. Professional associations are holding real elections to elect their leaders. On the economic side, more jobs are being created. You feel more people are making more money. They are buying goods. They were deprived of satellites under Saddam. Now almost every household has a satellite dish, at least one. Some of them have more than one. People are connecting with the world. They have internet now. Those who can afford it are getting internet connections or going to internet cafes. There is a connection with the world. Iraqis suddenly have burst upon the scene, or let's say the world has burst in upon the Iraqi scene. These are all good things. This doesn't mean that everything is perfect. We have a long way to go. The security situation is the biggest obstacle that we have in our move towards freedom and democracy.
And how potentially damaging could that be? Because if I go back to the newspapers that James and Marcy are talking about, we read about judges and we read about clerics who are being attacked. And and I, you know, from my own time there, have this kind of feeling in the pit of my stomach that one of those events, one car driving by with a machine gun opening up on a number of people outside one party headquarters, could start the whole thing unraveling. That's still a possibility. Am I being too pessimistic?
I think you are too pessimistic. You know, when they started bombing police stations in October, late October, I really sensed that the Iraqi people were beginning to mobilize. We now have a movement that was started in Iraq called Iraqis Against Terrorism, and it is spreading. There have been demonstrations in Baghdad and in some southern cities against these terrorism acts. And you have to keep in mind that the terrorists are targeting whatever is good about Iraq. They have targeted judges who were about to try criminals from the old regime. Those specifically were the judges who were targeted. Mm-hmm. They are targeting pipelines, which are the lifeline for Iraq. This is where Iraqi money comes from. And the sense is growing inside Iraq by the majority of the population that this is a small minority of Iraqis aided by externals who really do want ill for Iraq, who do not want Iraq to rise up. And there's a growing mass movement against this. But it is damaging. If we don't get this under control, we are going to have a tremendous problem. We must get this under control.
And we're out of time for our hour. James, thanks for your call. And Ambassador Rendal Rahim, thank you so much for spending an hour with us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
We'd like to have you back sometime in a few months and check in and see how things are going. Rendal Rahim is Iraq's new ambassador to the United States. You're welcome to continue this conversation. You can find us at our website. We are at www.theconnection.org. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.